And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF Kyle High with you this morning, and I hope everybody is having a good day. Cold out there, 26 degrees right now. A little bit of snow yesterday, but pretty clear out there today. And joining me in studio today for a green side up, we have James Coover and a David Scrantz. Guys, welcome. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Well, James, we'll go ahead and start with you today. Before we get started on your main subject, you do have a workshop upcoming, correct?
Yes. And so we have a leasing workshop on January the 23rd. I think that's going to be on a Saturday. And so this leasing workshop, we're going to talk a lot about contracts, about laws, about getting your own particular leases. And 50% of all ag land in Kansas is actually leased. And so there's very, very common that these things are. In fact, it's the most common question that we get in December and January. And we'll talk about a little bit about cash rents and crop share, but also a little bit of agricultural law as well. And so that's kind of the exact prime season because most contracts need to be written within the month of January for that agricultural law time frame. Mm-hmm. So, and in component with that, right now, me and Wendy were trying to send around basically a survey for agricultural producers and landlords to try to get an idea of what their rents are and basically their various contracts, getting some statistical data there so that way we actually have an idea of what's going on within the Wildcat District. The NAS, the Natural Agriculture Statistics Service, they do collect some of that data, but it's not very specific, and also they don't collect enough of it to be useful sometimes. And we always get a whole lot of questions, and so we're trying to collect stuff specifically for Wildcat District and enough of it to really tell us some good agricultural trends. And so that will be on January the 23rd. That will actually have the leasing workshop. And of course, we're going to be sending out surveys and trying to get all that data stuff before that so we can have some good data for the workshop.
All right. So a good workshop coming up. And that is on a Saturday, January 23rd. So get ready for that. So your main subject today, James, talk about, I believe you said sulfur fluoride?
Yeah, sulfur and chloride.
Chloride, yes. Okay. Chloride. So sometimes I don't hear correctly.
No, chloride's actually kind of in the category, but sulfur and chloride. And so sulfur and chloride, these are mobile nutrients, much like nitrogen is. And so they kind of fit a lot in the same category in nearly every way, honestly. And so they all have a gaseous form. They move through the soil within the water itself. And so, we mess with them often not in the same way. Generally, most sulfur and chloride comes from the breakdown of organic matter. However, we used to actually get it from acid rain.
Right.
But, ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've kind of cleaned up that stuff. And so we get a lot less of it from the atmosphere.
I remember when I was a kid, I was told, when acid rain falls, my skin will start melting. And so I was like always afraid, is this acid rain?
Yeah.
Is this acid rain? I do remember that. But it's gotten a little bit better, though, with that.
Yeah, oddly enough, you don't really think about it, but that acid rain, it's sulfur. It's, it's good for plants anyway.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah, in those small quantities anyway.
Right.
I don't know. But anymore, most of that stuff we have to apply it if it's going to be around. And wheat is commonly deficient in sulfur. It's probably the biggest trouble child, at least for when it comes to sulfur deficiency, is wheat. And that's largely because wheat is grown during the cold season when organic matter isn't turning over. And so we sometimes need to add some of that sulfur chemically to make up for that. And also wheat has a lot of hidden chloride deficiency. And chloride, it doesn't show up as well. And so within wheat and actually corn, basically any of the grass crops that we have, which are most of them, you can expect sulfur and chloride deficiencies to be a possibility. Oddly enough, soybeans are the ones that need the most sulfur by far. It's odd, but because they're grown during the warm season and just because they're physiologically they're actually able to suck in more sulfur, and they don't really have much of an issue, even though they use way more poundage of sulfur than anything else. Sulfur, like nitrogen, is part of plants' proteins. It's part of their enzymes. And so, you know, and chloride is actually part of the regulation within the plant, especially the photosynthesis part of it, and more important for actually disease suppression. And so chloride is a very major component within preventing fungal diseases from infecting that plant. And so, the sulfur, it has a tendency to cling to clay particles. Probably not as much, probably a little bit more than nitrogen. And the chloride, probably not so much, but there's a lot less of it that we need. And so the sulfur is just a little bit more clingy than the nitrogen, but still it leaches out really, really poorly, especially in rainy areas like this one, where there's lots of clay, although it does stick to the clay a little bit. And so often that we can find the sulfur, it will be trapped in the subsoil right above the bedrock. And within that layer, of course, around here, it's, 2 feet of clay maybe, if we're lucky, and then it's bedrock. Well, right above that bedrock is where sulfur likes to hang out, because it soaks down and it gets trapped in those heavy clays. But the problem is roots can't really get down that far, especially when they're young. They can't get down to get that sulfur, which is why often not we see nitrogen or sulfur deficiencies within the early spring time frame when plants are really starting to get growing, but they can't. And also in corn, if we plant that corn early, like in late March or early April, organic matter hasn't started to turn over yet, and the plant get to it. And so, when nitrogen, it's the deficiencies look different between nitrogen and sulfur, at least in the beginning. Later on, they can actually look very similar. It's almost impossible to tell the difference. But in the beginning, nitrogen will actually yellow the older leaves first. Well, not first, but it will yellow the older leaves. Within sulfur deficiency, it will yellow the newer leaves. And so that's kind of how you tell the difference between those two deficiencies. It's usually, they look, when you're driving down the highway at 70 miles an hour, they look exactly the same when driving, looking at the field. So if you stop and get out and look in the field, it'll be splotchy yellows here and there, especially on terrace channels or anywhere, the water collects and there's a lot of denitrification, and you can tell the transitions between those yellow spots to the nicer greener spots. That's the area to look for the differences, because when you have major deficiencies, the whole plant turns yellow,
right?
And then you can't tell the difference, and they look exactly the same. And so with chloride deficiency, it's less common to actually see anything. It's very hidden, and it's actually, even though that plant is deficient in chloride, it's really its ability to resist the funguses is what drops down, rather than actually any visual symptoms. And so that one, it's kind of tricky. All three of these can be tested for, because they are mobile nutrients. They can be tested for with a profile nitrogen test, which is 24 inches. However, around here, we don't have that much. And so it's really just as deep as you can take a soil sample. And really, when we send it off to the soil lab, you can't really test for one without the other. And so you just kind of get all the profile nitrogen, chloride, and sulfur test. I don't suggest grid sampling, because taking those profile soil tests is not easy. And so it takes a long time. You probably won't get to the full 10 cores that we usually suggest. But if you take just a couple of samples, maybe a sample every 40 acres or so, at least you can kind of get a general average across the field. Although it is highly variable within the field, at least we'll have an idea of what's out there. We want to take those tests probably maybe 3 weeks before we apply fertilizer. Because that stuff moves around a lot, and if you wait a whole season, it's going to change completely. But also because we need to get the test in and get all the recommendations and all that to know what we need to apply. So as for the fertilizers, what we need to do if we're deficient, and often not a lot of this stuff is actually applied without knowing, without taking a soil test. We just expect it to be down,
right?
Especially in high production situations. So with sulfur fertilizer, gypsum is actually has sulfur in it. It's sulfur chloride, and so you know that's a very common one we use. That sulfur is immediately available, and actually some of that sulfur will last from year to year. And so gypsum is pretty cheap stuff. It's, you know, a salt like a lot of the others. We also have ammonium sulfate, which is, you know, a supply of nitrogen as well. And the liquid form, which is the most common that we top dress, and especially in wheat, and especially in the spring when we need sulfur. And so we use a lot of ammonium triosulfate and potassium triosulfate. And so just a slightly different chemical formulation that makes it a liquid. We can mix it with the UAN, which is urea ammonium nitrate. Basically just mix it all up within the tank, and we can dribble it on. We have to dribble it on because it actually can burn the wheat plants in early, but we use dribble bars, and there's certain messages, certain things that you can do to make that less of a risk. Generally, we'll use around 10 to 20 pounds of sulfur to the acre, so this isn't very much. And that's the same thing with the chloride. 10 to 20 pounds, it's not very much. And so often that we just kind of throw it in without really knowing if it's there, because it's not terribly expensive to do anyway. We're already applying something, and so it makes sense. However, in chloride, we get almost all of it from potassium chloride, which is potash. That's kind of a misnomer. It's not really potash anymore. It's potassium chloride that we mine out of Florida. And so that potassium chloride, as long as we're applying about 40 pounds of potash, it supplies us all the chloride that we could possibly need. It's not an issue here because we're deficient in potassium, but pretty much all the rest of Kansas, they don't apply near as much potash, which is why the chloride deficiency can become an issue. And so, you know, those two nutrients, they're kind of relevant within this specific time frame, because, you know, we're looking at fertilizing our wheat and from the fall and into the spring. And those two are the two that are most commonly missed. I mean, we do a pretty good job with nitrogen, but the other two that are kind of the sisters of nitrogen, we don't always focus on.
All right, so some great information on that. I'll tell you what about sulfur. There is a town in Oklahoma called Sulfur, Oklahoma. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Yeah.
And they spell it differently. They spell it S-U-L-P-H-U-R.
Yeah.
However, the reason there's a reason the town is called Sulfur, because there is a sulfur spring somewhere in the town. You know when you're getting close to it. Oh, it smells. That part of town smells like a rotten egg. Literally does. So, so you know you're getting close to it. But that's the reason they called. But they spelled the town the name with a P H instead of a F.
Other places, like other nations that speak English, they actually spell sulfur differently.
Right.
And so yeah, that's the reason.
So yeah, it's I mean, like I said, you know when you're getting close to it, that part of town, because you start rolling up your windows like, nope, nope, you don't want to smell it. All right. So some great information there for you guys. And we're going to go over to Davin here for just a moment. And Davin, if you can just preview what you're going to be talking about coming up in the next segment.
Yeah, coming up after the break, I will be talking about preparing for kidding and lambing season. For some sheep and goat producers, they've already started kidding and lambing because they're raising kids and lambs for 4-H members to show in July. So their kidding and lambing season is going to start a little bit earlier. But for a lot of producers, it starts around January or February at the earliest. So this is the time of year to be doing some management practices for those does and ewes that are bred and in late gestation, and also making sure you have all the supplies you need.
All right. Well, thank you, Davin. All right. We're going to have that coming up after the break. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning. And welcome back, everybody. It's time for the second part of Greenside up here this morning on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Joining us in studio, James Coover and Davin Scrantz. Guys, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi.
All right. Before we get started, Davin, with you, James, one more time, you guys have a leasing survey coming up. Well, it'll be coming up next month, but it'll be coming up on the 23rd.
Yes. And so we'll have a leasing survey, and we'll hopefully have some places around the district where people can meet, but also we'll have a virtual option as well. And this leasing survey will cover everything from agricultural contracts, agricultural law, helping people getting their leasing contracts made for the next week is when those leasing contracts need to be done. And so this is the most common question this time of year is how to make these leases and what's a fair price and all that. And these are things we're going to cover within the workshop.
All right. So, again, that is coming up on January 23rd. Lots of ways to participate in that. Like you said, maybe a few areas around do that, but it also will be virtual as well to be able to do that from home. All right. Well, David, coming over to you, it's time for your segment. And what will you be talking about today?
Today, I'll be talking about preparing for kidding and lambing season and also caring for does and ewes in late gestation. I know I've seen a couple of pictures on Facebook and some 4-H members, their does have already kitted. And if you're raising goats or lambs for 4-Hers to show at the county fairs this summer, you're probably at the very beginning of your kidding and lambing season, so that those goats and sheep will be the perfect age for those kids to show at county fairs this summer. But I know for a lot of producers, they won't start kidding or lambing until more the January, February timeframe, or sometimes even a little bit later in the spring. Sometimes they'll have their goats and sheep due to all kid and lamb at the same time. Other times they'll break it up a little bit, just depending on personal preference. Some people like to have it all at once, get it kind of done and over with sort of thing. Other people like to spread it out so it's not so much at one time. But either way, right now, if you have sheep or goats due to kid or lamb in February, January area, the beginning of the year, those does are in late gestation right now. And late gestation is the last couple months of pregnancy, and it's a really important time for the development of the kids and lambs and also for the does and ewes' health. So those kids and lambs, they're growing at a rapid rate, and of course they're taking up more room. And that means the rooming capacity of the doe or the ewe is diminished. So she can't eat a lot at one time to meet her nutritional needs, but rather she's going to have to eat a little bit at several times throughout the day or have more nutrient-dense feed to consume to meet those nutritional needs, because during this time of late gestation they have greater energy needs, and especially with the cold weather they'll have increased energy needs because of that as well. So you want to make sure they have plenty of access to hay. This will also help keep them warm as they digest and break down that hay in their rumen. And then you also want to be supplementing them with good quality grain that has a protein content of about 16 to 18% and also a good fat content to meet their energy needs. And you don't have to give them a lot of grain, just about like a pound or so for each animal if they're a full size adult goats or sheep. If you happen to have Nigerian dwarfs or one of the miniature breeds of goats, then of course you'll be wanting to feed them less grain. And then along with that, you want to be checking them to see if they need to be dewormed. Right now it's colder weather, parasites aren't as big of a problem, but you do still want to double check that, because parasites tend to really take hold anytime an animal is under stress. And kidding or lambing does put that doe or ewe under a little bit more stressful conditions just because she's giving birth. So that gives parasites the chance to kind of take hold of that opportunity if there are any underlying parasite problems. So to check for that, you can check the color of their inner eyelid, which is referred to as Fomantra scoring. And you can give me a call at the extension office and I can go through it a little bit more in depth. But basically, if the color of the inner eyelid is red or pink, that means they're doing really good. They don't really have any internal parasite problems that are of a concern. But if it's that paler pink to white, that means that they do have internal parasites and you're going to need to deworm them. And the Fomantra scoring, it does really only indicate barbapole worms because they're a parasite that feeds off the blood of the animal. But usually if they have one type of parasite, they have other types of parasites.
Right.
So you'll, 'cause
they're very opportunistic.
Yes, exactly.
Are,
so. So the other way you can kind of be monitoring animals for parasite concerns is if they're skinny, if they're underweight, that can be an indicator. And also for goats, if their hair coat is rough or coarse, parasites can be a cause of that. Vitamin and mineral deficiency could also be a cause. And then for sheep, if they're wool sheep and they start to lose wool, it comes out very easily. That's a sign that they have parasites as well. So you want to double check that. Deworm any does or ewes that show those signs. And then the other thing you want to consider is vaccinating your does and ewes within the last month of pregnancy for Clostridium perfringens type C and D. And that is different types of perfringens, mainly type C and D, is what causes overeating disease. And this is a routine vaccination for sheep and goats that they get a yearly booster. And it's recommended for does and ewes to give that booster a month before kitting or lambing, because then the kids will get the passive immunity through the colostrum and it will help protect those kids. And this is especially important if you end up with any bottle kids or lambs, because they are very prone to overeating. So to vaccinate them for that, there's two different types of vaccines you can use. You can either do the CD&T vaccine, which protects against overeating disease and also tetanus, or you can do the Covaxin 8 vaccine, which protects also against tetanus, the CD&T type perfringens, and then also a few other types of perfringens. So it is a little bit of personal preference there. And then just be monitoring the does and ewes as they get closer to their kitting or lambing date. Hopefully you kind of have an idea of when they're due, so you can be keeping an eye on them. But if they're close to that due date, just be watching for signs of them giving birth. And this is important because sometimes they do need assistance delivering those kids and lambs. So if you're familiar with them and what's normal behavior for each animal, you'll have a better idea of when they're getting close to giving birth and then if they do need assistance or not. So just a few signs of that is if they don't come up to eat, of course that's something you want to be watching all year round because that's a sign that they're not feeling good. But if they're close to that due date, that can also be a sign that they're close to giving birth. They've maybe separated themselves from the herd a little bit, are seeking out a place to give birth. And then also if they have any discharge, that's a really good sign. If their udder is filling up and getting tight, those are a couple basic signs that they're getting close. And then if you do notice any signs of them being in active labor, having contractions but nothing progressing, that's when you want to consider just kind of going in and checking things out, because sometimes with the kid or the lamb will get maybe kind of crossed up. Two might be trying to come at once and you need to sort that out, or a head or a leg is just positioned a little bit wrong, where if you sort that out, then you can give that doe or you a hand and help get everyone off to a good start. And then kind of following up, late gestation management is once those kids and lambs are on the ground, is really important to make sure they get colostrum, preferably within the first 12 hours, but definitely within the first 24 hours, because colostrum is that first milk. It's nutrient rich, and it also has important immunoglobulins that help the kids and the lambs develop their kind of like immune system, protect them right from getting sick early on. And they also need that first milk to get off to a good start. And if they, unfortunately, if they don't get colostrum within the first 24 hours at least, then they probably won't make it. So it's really important, even in a pasture situation where you're not interacting with the goats and lambs as much, you can kind of just watch the kids and lambs, make sure that they're nursing, if they're active, if they have full bellies. Those are all usually good signs that they've received that colostrum. If you're more familiar with your goats and lambs, and again, it all kind of depends on setup, but if you're in a smaller pen or they're friendlier, then you can even kind of clear the teats on the doe or the ewe and make sure those kids nurse right away. And the other thing that's important for kids and lambs is you're going to want to dip their umbilical cord in iodine, and that helps prevent any infection going up the umbilical cord and getting to the kid or lamb, which can develop into joint ill or navel ill later on.
All right, so good stuff there. One more thing I did want to ask you is, of course, is it still considered rutting season for deer? Because I almost hit one the other day. So because he just came running across the road and he just kept going, he never stopped. So
yeah, it is at the tail end of that. So kind of like through December is the tail end. I know last week, one evening, I was going to visit friends and I passed quite a few deer.
Right.
Yeah. I think I passed four. Or they passed me. They ran across the road in front of me. Yeah. So yeah, you still want to be watching for
them.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
Luckily I saw them. I saw it before he even got there because it was kind of an open area, but he just was flying and he just crossed the road. I didn't even look and just kept going, and I almost hit him, and I was just like, oh my goodness. I had to stop for a second. And then
yeah.
I slowly started moving on again. So yeah, that dude was flying. He was ready to go. All right, so well, guys, if anybody has any more questions about any of the, these things, how can they get a hold of you?
They can reach us by calling any of the extension offices. I'm usually at the Independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
And the number for Gerard is 620-724-8233. But like Dave said, call any office and you can get a hold of us.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming in today. We really do appreciate it. And if I do not see you guys again before Christmas, have a very Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
You too.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break. But when we come back, we're going to start open line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.